Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
So, Carl, I mean, last time we recorded, we were talking about this question that we got that was on what does it take to be an expert reliability engineer? And I want to distinguish that I don't think they were asking what does it take to be like certified as a CRE or a professional engineer. I think the notion of expert in this realm is more along the lines of like a technical fellow within an organization. You know, like a good friend of mine here in the Valley with Western Digital a couple years ago, and he asked me for an endorsement for him to add to his package to apply to become a technical fellow in Western Digital, in the company, which is different than being a fellow of a professional society, right? This is one inside the company that you're elevated in the technical ranks to senior management, essentially. But it's based on the recognition of your technical prowess was a piece of it. Now, it obviously had people skills and teaching and contributions to the larger audience or larger peer group, but it was really focused on the technical side. And so we mentioned it in the last episode is that to be an expert at something is not just technical skills, which is a part of it, but it's also the people skills. And so we talked about that last time.
So now we can say, okay, so we've covered the subject of people skills. It's important to be able to communicate and share in things, but now we have to look at what are the technical skills that are important to gain expertise in reliability engineering. Reliability engineering is a fairly broad subject. I'm on this SAE G41 team that publishes the FMEA handbook. I'm sorry, the reliability handbook and the reliability engineering standard for SAE. In the handbook, I think there's 88 methods that are in the handbook.
Yeah,
that fall in the bucket called reliability engineering.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to send you this question. I saw this morning, by the way. It was if you had five tools, what are your top five tools you use most often? Right. Mm-hmm. Well, there's 88 of them, and my answer was pretty vague. It was at high level buckets because sometimes I need to do this or this or this or this for risk assessment. I can't pick a favorite tool. I have to do risk assessment. It's a larger bucket. But yeah, 88 methods. I would never do all of those in any one project, right?
Well, and there's a downside to having a favorite tool. Because think about it. If your favorite tool is, let's just say, design of experiments, and you've had some good success in it, you've taken classes, you've done lots of projects, maybe you're certified in some way, and then you go on your next project, the widget project, you're going to be inclined to start using design of experiments. Whereas the widget project, if you do your gap assessment, you know what the objectives are for the widget from a reliability standpoint, and you did a gap assessment, DOE may not be the right tool to use at a particular time.
Well, that's a subtle part of, I think, what separates an expert, right? You can be perceived as an expert in DOE, and people will call you and invite you to do when it's recognized that they want to do a DOE, or they call you and say, is this a good application for DOE? Then you're an expert in design of experiments, right? But if you're an expert in reliability engineering, I think or a different way, you would say, all right, here's this project. We're starting this project. DOE may be the right tool for us. Let's use that. And you know, have enough technical competence in it to either do it or get the DOE expert in. I think there's two levels of expertise. One is, are we using the right tools and can we use those competently? Or I'm really, really good at accelerated life testing, and that's what I do day in and day out, and that's the only thing I do. And I only get invited or work on projects where I can do that, right? But you have to be, whether you're a DOE expert or an ALT expert or whatever, a specific one is avoid that everything looks like a nail if that's the only hammer in your toolbox, yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be the pitfall. Let me just stipulate on expertise on any given subject. Let's say it's go back to the accelerated life testing. Mm-hmm. To be an expert or to be very knowledgeable, because sometimes the word is off-putting to say, I'm an expert. But to be very skilled, very knowledgeable, and very helpful on a subject, you need to understand the subject well. You should get trained in it, take courses in it. And so let's presuppose someone has done that.
And have experience in it, too.
Have experience in it, absolutely. And so part of this, though, then when you've got this basic knowledge, you want to think about or apply, when do you use it, when do you not use it, and what are the limitations of the tool? So I think once you've gained the expertise, something to think about on a particular subject is, when is it most useful, when is it not useful, and what are the limitations? Because every method in reliability engineering has limitations to it.
Yep.
So I think that's part of the path of gaining expertise.
Yeah, I think, and that's kind of what I sparked when you talked about, you know, the DOE expert, is that I think it separates a person that is familiar or knowledgeable or good at a method or a technique or a particular application and one that actually understands it. And you phrased it exactly right. What are the assumptions?
Oh, yes.
That, right.
Very good.
I understand the nuances of this well enough to bring this tool, which will help us solve this problem, and understand the trade-offs. It's not just we're going to apply a Y-bolt. And I've seen it way too many times, and I'm sure you have. If somebody gets some field data, they drop it in a Y-bolt plotting software, and they get a plot, and they're off to the races. And they don't know if it's a good fit or not. They don't know how to interpret it. They got their plot or off and run. We did Weibull analysis. We're so happy. Like, no, you got to think about this a little more, guys.
So that really is an essential element to gaining expertise, is to understand the assumptions that go into a particular application of a method or a project. One other comment, Fred, is the depth and breadth. I believe personally, if I'm coaching someone or mentoring or helping a colleague, I would want them to have a some understanding. The phrase I'm thinking of jack of all trades, master of none.
Mm-hmm.
I want a both answer to this. I want someone to understand the breadth of reliability engineering. So they should be conversant with enough to know when to hand off to somebody, when an expert in that subject is needed. So you want to have some understanding of all aspects of reliability engineering. And then you want to gain expertise in one or two much deeper.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a good career path for reliability engineer does both, because otherwise you end up with a hobby horse where everything—it's the hammer and the nail thing.
Right.
And so, if you have a general understanding of lots of different tools and methods, that gets you away from the hammer and nail. But you don't want to be just the jack of all trades, master of none. I think it's important to have a true, deeper expertise in certain tools of reliability.
Yeah, and I've got to ask that question. So what area should I specialize in? You know, what things should I be really good at? And it says, well, it's opportunistic combined with your interest, right? If you have opportunities to do data analysis and that really grabs your interest and you develop a passion for it, it becomes much, much easier to open those textbooks or take those classes or experiment and study and develop that deep understanding of that data analysis techniques. But if statistics is the last thing you want to do, well, maybe, no offense here, Carl, maybe facilitating FMEAs and or failure analysis techniques would be your forte, and get really good at understanding risk and prioritization and understanding the tools and tricks and trades of a failure analysis lab. You know, it might be two different areas instead of statistics. You need to be familiar with statistics because it's still going to be around you. Mm-hmm. You don't, but if that's not where your opportunity is, or your passion, interest. And I think it also changes as your organization changes, as your opportunities change, as your interests change, you can continue to learn. I think that's another hallmark of a technical expert, is they learn one thing and then they stop. No, if I need to learn about capacitors, I'm going to know. I think what makes an expert is their ability to learn and to ask the right questions and to absorb that information, to appear to be one step ahead of everybody else. But it's only because you are willing to ask questions and observe and learn and read and study and those kind of things.
Well, so let's outline those a little bit, because if we're guiding people or recommending that people gain an expertise in some portion of reliability engineering, then I agree completely that there's two aspects to that decision. One is the interest, something that interests you, excites you, gets you motivated. That's important, because it's difficult to be a lifelong expert on something that you're not interested in.
That's right.
And so you want to pick that. But on the other hand, you use the word opportunity, and I think of similar words like that, which is what are the needs? Where's the company going? Where's technology going? And so what's the right method that's very useful to? So for example, when there's a long trend that's been going on to shorten product development times.
Yeah.
Using my vehicle experience, used to take upwards of 6 years to introduce a vehicle. And then we said, okay, 4 years, 2 years, 1 year, we just kept shortening. There are good, solid business reasons why that occurred. But what that does is it's moved certain techniques to the forefront. And designing in became much more important, because you didn't have the time to do test and fix treadmill forever.
Right.
So there's opportunities or types of methods that lend themselves to where the company is going, and there's areas of personal interest. And so you want to blend those. You want to get those lists laid out and find the intersection of those lists, and then grab those topics that intersect the opportunity as well as the interest and run with those. I think that's really important. The other comment I was going to make is the way you can do lifelong learning is to understand the importance of humility. Because if you think you know it all, of all, you're wrong.
That's right. and we know that for sure.
We're positive that that
we're experts in this. We know you got that wrong.
So you want to understand and adopt the attitude, the truth, which is you don't know it all. And I'm not accusing people of this. I have seen some people.
I've got a few in mind. Yeah.
So the best attitude is you don't know everything, and that you want to learn things. And so find that area of passion that is an opportunity from a business standpoint or a company standpoint, and then start learning more and more about it. And that's a path.
Yeah, definitely. There's, and it goes back to what we talked about with the people side of this thing, is that ability to learn from everybody you talk to and engage with and so on. Everybody has a different point of view of the world. And as a technical expert, I need to understand, you know, the technician's point of view of how this equipment operates. I need to understand the bank teller's view of how I use my computer to do a transaction. I need to understand the software programmer's point of view of the constraints and trade-offs that they're facing in order to make a package that's provides a particular function. Now, I'm not an expert in any of all those things, but I filter it, what I learn from them and what their constraints are, their assumptions, their approaches, their criteria, their objectives, in through this reliability part, because reliability is in balance with all of these other disciplines and all these other people that touch and interact with whatever product or system we're working with. And so whether it's the person on the shop floor that's making this widget, or the technician maintaining that equipment, or the manufacturing engineer that's trying to optimize the line or reduce variability, every single of those people, and all the way through the life cycle, all the way to the end of the person junking it out in a junkyard, there's opportunity to learn about how the trade-offs that we make and suggest and influence in our expertise actually pay out. And you can take it from a component level to a system level. And I think that ability to learn just enhances your expertise.
Yeah, the very good. I agree. And for an individual that is, and everybody is to some degree or another, working on a career path, that ability to learn and to understand your role in relation to other roles. So in other words, you need to learn about other people and what they do and how you fit into it. That picture is important. There's another fork in the road, so to speak, for anybody that's in reliability engineering, becoming an expert. And that fork in the road is whether you become the true expert technically, or whether you end up in or want to pursue reliability management. And so I don't know, and then let me ask this question. Does the term expertise or expert fit reliability management, or is it only the reliability engineering side? I tend to think you could be an expert in any subject, including reliability management. But what do you think, Fred?
I'm just thinking through the different people I've worked with and under as part of, they were my managers. And I had a few managers that were technically gifted, right? They were the PhD kind of person. They couldn't lead their way out of a paper bag. They took every step and every technique and every trick in the book to avoid making decisions. It was infuriating. But anyway, then I worked with another person that was, to my mind, a true reliability expert, and then a true reliability expert or reliability manager expert. Had that gift of being able to lead, inspire, but also you could go to, and I've had a couple bosses like this. One director of engineering, I could go to her and say, I'm struggling with this. And she would never tell me the answer, but she would ask 2-3 questions and the answer became obvious. You know, she was brilliant.
That is great. That's a gift.
It is. And she was she was a material scientist and she understood fundamentals of science and chemistry. She was a gifted technologist, but a brilliant manager, brilliant leader. And I've had the privilege of working with a couple people like that combine both of those. So I think whether you're a manager or not, whether you're a technical fellow, you still have those management roles or leadership role. And I think that we talked about that these two things don't separate.
Yeah. And in fact, when I used the word manager or management, I wasn't even, the concept in my mind was not to constrain it to the title of management. But if you are, let's say you've been given the job of the reliability of the widget project, then you have to use some of the tools that we call reliability management, such as a plan. You need to learn how to plan. And so that's an expertise, planning and organizing and doing things in the right sequence and who's assigned to do what, and working with others to make that happen is also an expertise. So I was just broadening it a little bit. You can have expertise in failure mechanisms, and you can have expertise in reliability planning.
Yep. Yeah, very true. Now, one of the stories, and I think I've talked about it on the show a couple of times, was, I don't know. Do you remember, Carl? I usually start the story with, I got a phone call on a Friday afternoon, and it was, Fred, are you where I can talk? Nobody can overhear you? Yeah. I'm not supposed to be talking to you about this. It was kind of the start of the conversation. I'm like, okay, Bill, you okay? Is everything all right? Oh, yeah. We had an event. And I'm not allowed to write it down or tell anybody about it, but we had a visual thermal event. Like, okay, let me process that a little bit. You mean like a fire? No, don't say that.
Don't say
that. And so anyway, that started, him and his team was doing, they were doing failure analysis. They're supporting a great big ramp up of a project to oversee the redesign of the product that was causing these issues and these opportunities for improvement, as they like to phrase it. Basically, one of the products caught on fire and burned a house down. So it was, they needed to solve it. They had it isolated to a multi-layer ceramic capacitor that for some reason turned white hot. Now, most of the time when a capacitor gets too much current, it just blows right off the board, right? It just explodes. Well, this particular one turned into a ceramic heater and was carrying a couple thousand degrees. And I asked him, is that Celsius or Fahrenheit? He says, it doesn't matter. It's hot.
Okay.
So I, you know, and he's, well, what can I do for you? I was sitting in a corporate job and he says, we're not allowed to talk to the vendor. But you're a corporate. You can call anybody and just tell them you're from HP as long as you don't tell them you're talking about this issue. But can you go find out how this happens? How can this capacitor turn into a white hot blazing blowtorch? And so I spent 2 weeks and that boss I mentioned earlier, she was a material scientist. I got all of her and we talked about it a little bit. And she showed me some of the chemistry that happens in dielectric materials that sometimes under the right conditions, they turn into a conductor. And then I talked to the director of engineering at the capacitor place and, you know, said, here's some of the information I got. Here's some of the evidence I got. What's going on here? He goes, oh, we don't like to tell people about this because it makes them afraid. It's very rare, but it can happen under these circumstances. And you're exactly right. And so in the span of less than 2 weeks and a bit of research and studying and talking to a handful of the right people, I became the capacitor expert.
So the go-to person.
It was. And so I did a webinar, right? It's kind of what I do. And talked about what I learned and how important it is not to crack multi-layer ceramic capacitors. And I got, within a month, I got 12 phone calls from different parts of the organization saying, I'm not supposed to talk to you. This is an internal problem only, but could you answer a few questions about, and I got flown all over the world to go solve capacitor problems. And and my boss said, you're getting all this praise and people are looking for you. Do you want to be the capacitor expert? And I says, what? I just helped a friend of mine solve a problem. Now you're two steps ahead of everybody else on this. You put it all together and you can teach it. So
which is so important what you're saying here, because when you help people solve problems, you're not going about it to be the quote expert unquote, you're going about it to genuinely help people.
Yeah.
And then if you walk that path and if you decide you want to learn, be more knowledgeable about capacitors, you could read a book or, you know, take a course and to gain it. But the key there is you started off with genuinely wanting to help people. And that is a big point that you made. Great story.
Yeah. No, that was, it was one that it just, you know, after a month or 6 weeks after this was all happening, I sat down and I was like, do I want to be the capacitor expert? At that point, then it became easier because I had a good solid foundation. I had all these contacts to build on and all the papers and all this stuff to really go on. And it became a big part of my career of dealing with capacitor issues in one form or
Excellent.
Another. Yeah.
Very, very good. Well, this is probably a good time to ask the audience, people that are listening, as to what are your areas of expertise and how did you get to those areas? And what do you think as to the subject of becoming more and more expert? What are the elements and the important points that you'd like to know more about? And do you have any questions you'd like to ask us? So I think this could be a really good one for audience feedback.
Oh, definitely. And you can certainly get a hold of us a number of ways at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR is one way. You can also find our contact information on our about pages on Ascendo. Plus, both Carl and I are active on LinkedIn, and you can find us there. And we certainly look forward to your contributions, ideas, and questions. And thanks to the person that asked us this question, is what does it take to be an expert reliability engineer? And it's such a juicy question. I think it was great.
Yes. Very much so. Well, very good, Fred.
All right. Thanks, Carl. We'll talk to you later. Go out and be an expert today.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.